You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, we'll preview President Trump's first official State of the Union address. Now, Wisconsin's Western District led the nation in farm bankruptcies last year, according to a new federal report. The district cuts a jagged line across more than half of the state, covering 42 counties. And the bankruptcies come at a time when the economy seems to have recovered from the Great Recession. Wisconsin's current unemployment rate is lower than the national average. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How is your farm doing? Are you a farmer who is struggling with debt, or do you maybe know someone who is? What's causing issues for you or those in your community? Email us at ideas@wpr.org or call us now at 800-642-1234. Joining us now is Paul Mitchell. He's a professor of agricultural and applied economics and the director of the Rank Agribusiness Institute, both at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Thanks. You're welcome.
So Wisconsin's Western District had 28 Chapter 12 bankruptcies last year. That's the category for family farmers or fishermen. How does that number look in context with national numbers?
As a district, the court districts are, I think there's 94 of them, and it's the highest. Mm-hmm. You add it up across the state, so the whole state of Wisconsin compared to the other states, and we had 41, so that's second highest. Only Georgia was ahead of us, and so it's still very high on a national scale.
And comparing it to previous years in Wisconsin, what does that look like?
There's been a big mm-hmm. uptick this year.
And it does seem, like we said, that the economy has recovered in large part since the recession, but this would seem to indicate that maybe farmers have missed out on some of the benefits from that recovery.
Yeah, the agricultural, the farm sector is on a different cycle than the whole economy at some times. And this time is roughly the third year in a row of falling farm incomes at a national scale and in Wisconsin. And it seems to have stabilized at the aggregate statistics, but it's much lower than it has been. And so agriculture, particularly corn, soybeans, dairy, have had another bad year after another bad year after another mm-hmm. bad year. And so a lot of that capital, it's just that stress from all that capital being gone is really starting to show.
So what explains that difference between kind of general recovery and how the agricultural sector recovers? And is that common? Has that happened with other ebbs and flows of the overall economy?
Yeah, that's a very common result. I mean, just look back at your history. The Roaring Twenties was also the time when agriculture had a very bad time. That's, over almost 100 years ago. And ag sector does not always move with the rest of the economy. It's not it's not our full driving force of our U.S. economy. There's many other sectors. And so it's, again, another situation here where crop prices, milk prices are low relative to costs, and farmers are under a lot of financial stress.
You mentioned that a couple of times now, so let's dig into that a little, that low commodity prices for corn, soybeans, milk, that's affecting farmers. What are the driving forces that dictate whether those prices are high, low, stable, or not?
This is basic economics in the sense of supply and demand. We just have a lot of supply relative to the demand. And more than anything, it's export markets. For all those commodities, exports are a sizable portion. And so as soon as export markets slow down or just overall demand slows down, you've got an excess. And then the prices come down. I always say never underestimate the capacity of agriculture to oversupply the market. We seem to be able to do that all the time.
And is that at least in part because technology is getting better and better and more efficient, that we're probably going to be producing more than we need on maybe less land?
It's partly the technology. It's just acreages. Part of it really is there's always a cyclical nature is that you make decisions of what to plant and you have to wait several months. So it's not like a just-in-time kind of decision where you can look at the price, make a decision. Mm-hmm. You have to, there's a big long lag cycle built in. The average cow or the beef we eat is 2 or 3 years old. Hogs are 6 months old. Crops take 6 months. There's that built-in lag factor that kind of separates the time you make decisions from when you finally find out some of these things like the prices.
So maybe in other sectors of the economy, producers are or manufacturers are able to pivot a little more quickly when they see different trends coming.
It helps, yes. That's part of it. It's just we have those natural cycles where agriculture and other industries, they do have some of that still. But yes, we just face more of that in agriculture.
We are talking right now with Paul Mitchell. He's professor of agricultural and applied economics and director of the Rank Agribusiness Institute, both at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And those farms that are going into bankruptcy, those farmers that are having to declare bankruptcy, what do we know about, for instance, the size of those farms, or if they tend to be producing one particular product more than others?
We've looked at the data, and I've talked to the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection's Farm Center, the law firm that's been handling a lot of these, and there's really no pattern. It's some of them are dairy farms, some are crop farms only. Some cranberries having a very rough time. We're a major cranberry state. We produce about half the world's cranberries. Cranberries has been a long-term slump. Some are small, some are large. It's not really any one style of farm. It's all of agriculture is under a lot of stress for, crops on that side and dairy. And so it hits all of our farmers in the state in some way, shape, or form.
And what about the value of farm? A USDA report said that farm values actually increased by 9.5% in Wisconsin last year. How does that play into this equation?
Yeah, that's a good point. Last year, the land values increased 9.5%. And so somebody out there thinks, the long-term investment is good. And it's primarily dairy. The long-term prospects are positive, and there's money to be made. And these aggregate statistics on the average cost of production, the average farm price, there are individuals who are different than those averages. And so some operations are definitely able to have a low enough cost to make a good living, to make a good return on investment at these current prices. And so those are the individuals or companies or organizations, trusts that are investing in the land and increasing the prices.
So for an individual homeowner just living, in a town or a city, when your property value goes up, so do your taxes. Is that also an element with farmland? How does that work?
That's my understanding. The responsiveness to the value isn't always the same, and the mill rates or the percentages are different. But yes, as you have higher taxes to pay the higher because of the higher land values.
We're talking about bankruptcies on farms in Wisconsin, and that the Western region has led the nation in the last year in those farm bankruptcies. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And let's go to Joan calling from Watertown. Hi, Joan.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I'm a small-time vegetable grower in Watertown. I grow organically. And I've been reading a lot about the meat producers in this country that are organic, producing organically, and the rising demand for organic meats, and how those meat producers have to get their feed, their grain, from other countries because there's not enough organic grain being grown here to supply them. And I think this is something that these growers could turn to.
That's a really interesting point, Joan. And Paul, that's an interesting differentiation that we hadn't mentioned, is the difference between organic and conventional agriculture. What do we know about differences there?
Yeah, she's exactly right. We actually have to import a lot of our organic grain, particularly corn and soybean, for both human and animal consumption for livestock. And it's actually very important here in Wisconsin and with our dairy industry, those cows to maintain Organic Valley or pick your other favorite organic supplier of milk, those cows have to be fed organic feed. But surprisingly, we have to import it. And I've heard this before, and we're trying to understand why can't we grow organic corn and soybeans? We're the world's largest producer of both those crops, yet we're not able to produce enough to feed our livestock, or the organic livestock. And I think part of it is just farmers are reluctant to change. It's a 3-year transition period. Some people have a harder time making the transition, and the cost is different. And to be honest, some of the growers declaring bankruptcy, my understanding, some of them actually are organic dairies. And so they have been facing tight margins as well. Organic Valley has reduced the prices, is my understanding, that they guarantee for their producers. And so even they are feeling the pinch. It's not just it's definitely better than some of the conventional growers, but it's not like they're immune to this oversupply issue.
Paul Mitchell is a professor of agricultural and applied economics and the director of the Rank Agribusiness Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We're taking a look at farm bankruptcies, particularly in the western region of Wisconsin. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think can be done to prevent future farm bankruptcies? Do you know a farmer who has filed for bankruptcy or is struggling with debt? If you're in danger of having to file for bankruptcy, what would help you avoid that? Email us at ideas@wpr.org or give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a moment. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're continuing our discussion about farm bankruptcies with Paul Mitchell, professor of agricultural and applied economics and director of the Rank Agribusiness Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Western Wisconsin led the nation in Chapter 12 bankruptcies last year. And Paul, what do we know about what happens when these family farmers file for bankruptcy? Are they leaving the industry, or is this a way to catch up with debt and try to continue in the sector?
I'm no legal expert by any means, but it's my understanding that Chapter 12 is specially meant for agricultural operations farms. And my understanding is it helps them maintain the land ownership potentially. But again, I'm no legal expert. I just do know if they get to a certain size, larger the debt overall, I think it's somewhere over $4 million. By law, they have to file under Chapter 11 than the largest operations do.
And that's the bankruptcy that most people...
Yeah, that's a consumer or a homeowner or just anybody, a normal citizen that would have to file under that.
I wonder, especially in thinking about what you said earlier, Paul, that there's that long lag time in the agricultural sector and agricultural producers being able to respond to trends because, you know, you don't have a full grown cow or a fully grown field of corn or soybeans instantaneously. I wonder, do some farmers take on debt thinking that prices are going a certain way, and then they have too much debt for what the market ends up being when they're eventually able to sell in it.
That's exactly what happens, is a lot of these farms take a mix of their own money and they get some sort of an operating loan to buy the inputs to put a crop in. There's fertilizers, there's fuel to run the machinery, maybe you need new equipment, you have to buy different chemicals, different treatments for your the seed, all that stuff, hiring people to help you, and usually people get operating loans. A lot of the seed and stuff is locked in, and by this time of year, most farms have already bought that. The farms that are financially stressed didn't make enough money last fall when they sold their crop, or are in the process of selling their crop now to get another operating loan, and they don't have enough equity, enough capital of their own money to do that. And so now they're scrambling, trying to find a way to find enough money to put a crop in. Because if you can't put a crop in, how do you justify having the land? Do you rent it out then? Well, now it's getting late for someone to rent it. And you see, it's kind of it snowballs.
Let's go to the phones at 800-642-1234. And Owen in Wyoega is up. Hi, Owen.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So as far as the dairy sector goes, I'm employed on a dairy farm. I'm a young farmer that would like to start my own farm, but due to the cost of capital investment, I've been all but talked out of it by anybody I talk to from the USDA or FSA or even professors at the Fox Valley Technical College where I'm enrolled. But the problem I see is, this is simple economics, we're overproducing milk to the point where the demand is lesser than the production. And this continues to happen for a lot of different reasons. But the biggest factor I see is, when I wrote the USDA, they told me that if you milk 2,000 cows or more, your economies of scale are better and your profit margins are better. That's understandable, but we get more and more people that are milking 2,000 cows that want to milk 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, and then our government is continuing to work with them, giving them crop loss insurance and benefits that they receive from those types of programs, while their neighbor gets choked out, basically. The small, independent family farmer can't continue to make money selling milk from 90 to 100 cows that he can take care of by himself without a bunch of outside labor.
Thanks for that call, Owen, and I want to give Paul a chance to respond. So it sounds like Owen's saying that the focus is on more and more, but that just makes the overproduction worse and worse.
Yeah, I mean, this is the standard farm problem we've been facing for decades, and our he's right in the sense our policies have been oriented towards keeping the profit or prices low or generating a lot of supply. And that's what it, I think the best name for this is called Cochrane's treadmill. Willard Cochrane is a professor at University of Minnesota who coined that term back in the 50s for farmers are racing ahead all the time, trying to keep up with these falling real prices because the supply keeps going up and up because we keep finding ways to make more milk, make more corn, make more soybeans, make more beef. Mm-hmm. And it's been the continual problem of agriculture in this country for like 100 years.
Paul, you said that this has been a problem for a long time, but why might Western Wisconsin be hit so hard versus the eastern part of the state or even Minnesota?
Yeah, I've been trying to get a sense of that, and it's difficult. Nobody seems to have a good idea. The best I've heard is, just like Owen mentioned, it's these smaller dairy farms. Some of them, there was a big dairy price collapse a while back, and some of them stopped being dairy farmers and decided just to do crops, and now they're having a hard time doing that maybe. That's all I can think, because that's the only way that really differentiates Wisconsin from these other states. You know, why isn't Illinois having this high numbers? Why isn't Iowa? It's our dairy farmers. And it's not like it's just them, but I think that's why our numbers are a little higher. I think we're losing some of these smaller dairy farms, but it's not just them. Like I said, it's a lot of the farms are facing the same pressure.
Owen, thanks for that call. Let's go now to Lyric in Blanchardville. Hi, Lyric.
Hi, thank you, Judith and Paul. I really enjoyed the two calls before, the gal talking about organic gardening and then the fellow that just talked about the small independent local farms. I live in Lafayette County, which is in southwest Wisconsin, and the geography of the land is that this is driftless. There's lots of steep hills and gullies. It's not flat like Illinois. It's not flat like Iowa. So the small independent farmer does really well if we had a better train transportation method to get the wonderful organic food from this area to Chicago and Minneapolis. It would really help the economy of the state and this local area. So I think geography has a lot to do with it. They can't just gut all the hedgerows, and they've got hills. They've got wonderful produce here and no way to get it to a big market.
Thanks so much for that call, Lyric. And so, you know, I know one of the things that we're going to hear a lot about in the State of the Union tonight is infrastructure investment. And it sounds like Lyric's pointing to the need for better infrastructure for getting the products to the consumers.
Yeah, that's a common problem that shows up. We had our Ag Outlook Forum last week, and we asked some of we had some, we'll call them farms/businesses that the Crave Brothers Cheese, for example, Farmstead Cheese, and they talk about the need for roads and infrastructure is an important, what can the public sector provide for them? And that's the case, is a lot of these productive areas are not near where the people live. And it's always a problem getting the food to where the people are. It's a huge problem in South America. Argentina and Brazil have really come on growing corn and soybeans. They literally have to waste some of it because they can't get it out. A lot of our grain moves down the Mississippi River Valley, and that lock and dam system is getting older and older and older and falling behind. And so trains and semis, but then they have roads. They get worn out.
Sally from Reedsburg called and wondered if some of our farm exports have been affected with the Trump administration really throwing into question a lot of the existing multilateral trade agreements. How does that play into this?
What that has done is create a lot of uncertainty on what the price is going to do. We have our expectations. The markets, they trade the futures down in Chicago at the Mercantile Exchange or other exchanges. And the big uncertainty is all these crops, corn, soybeans, milk. Like half our soybeans roughly are exported in some way, shape, or form as crushed as soybean meal or oil. Corn, it's 10 to 12, 15%, somewhere similar to that with dairy or milk or cheeses. And that all that uncertainty about what is going to happen, because Mexico and Canada are big trade partners in China. And so it creates uncertainty about where that price is going to go. And so it increases the risk is what it really does. And then when we finally get these prices, who knows if there's a trade issue, something will move those prices up or down.
Is NAFTA, because it involves our closest neighbors, is that one of the most important trade agreements that kind of needs to be stabilized for the agricultural sector to feel confident?
It's one of them, obviously. Mm-hmm. China's our other big trade partner. And we haven't done anything with those yet, really, but it's the uncertainty that we're talking about doing it. And, I mean, already Mexico has started sourcing more of its grains for its poultry industry from Argentina. They're moving their export demands to switching their sourcing. And so that once you switch, it's kind of hard to switch back again. It's you kind of get those relationships, those contracts, those ways of moving things. So it has this uncertainty is starting to have some effects.
Earlier, Paul, you said that often when there's some kind of an economic recovery in the country as a whole, that the agricultural sector tends to lag a little behind. Are there indications, are there reasons for optimism that while it's been slower, that the agricultural sector is going to catch up with the recovery that we've seen?
I think the one thing I noticed in our Ag Outlook Forum last week was the demand for meats have been growing. And that's something we tend to buy when we have a little more income. And so as the economy recovers, and then those cattle, those hogs, the chickens and other, you know, turkeys and such, they all eat grain. It's the cheapest, easiest way to put gain on an animal. And so that's why there's a large chunk of those crops are used for feed. That's a promising point, is that demand for meat is increasing.
And Paul, I know that you also work with UW Extension. Are there resources out there for farmers who might be struggling and are trying to figure out creative ways to avoid getting into this bankruptcy situation?
We put together a couple things. This has been an ongoing problem for the last couple of years, and some of the state specialists put together considerations for managing grains in low price years, low margin years, and that came out last year, and it's still available. You can talk to your local county extension agent to get that. They've made videos, you can watch them, and I would call it very focused on the agronomic, how to make your crop management and stuff. And I think from my understanding, a lot of farmers have already squeezed as much out of their cost side as they can in terms of input management. But there's always room for a few more dollars maybe. The other one is there's been some various training sessions for those working with farmers, how to work with stressed out individuals and what to do.
Paul, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was Paul Mitchell. He's a professor of agriculture and applied economics and the director of the Rank Agribusiness Institute at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about Western Wisconsin's spike in farm bankruptcies and what that could mean for the region. Now, President Trump will deliver his first official State of the Union address tonight. He's expected to unveil his $1 trillion infrastructure plan and talk about immigration reform. He'll also use the time, like all presidents before him, to tout his accomplishments and appeal for help from Congress to achieve legislative goals in the year ahead. But tonight's speech comes amid a cloud of controversy from events that have plagued his first year in office, from the ongoing Russia investigation to a disastrous rollout of his travel ban. Donna Hoffman is with us now. She's an associate professor of political science and department chair at the University of Northern Iowa. Donna, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you.
As we just referred to tonight's speech as his first official State of the Union, what was it that he gave to Congress a year ago, right after he had taken office?
Well, that actually is much like a State of the Union, but technically it's typically not called that. The Constitution gives presidents this power that they are from time to time to report on the State of the Union and recommend measures that they shall judge necessary and expedient. Obviously, when you've taken office only 2 weeks or so before, it's kind of hard to report on the State of the Union. But presidents do typically give a joint address an address to a joint session of Congress, I should say, that functions much like a State of the Union address. We just don't technically call it that. So in it, they will still claim credit for things they may have done. Usually that's a pretty remote possibility. But they will also, and this is one of the things that we're interested in, suggest policy recommendations. So using that reporting and recommending grant of power that they have from the Constitution to say to Congress, while the American public and even the world is watching, here's an initiative, here's something I want you to do, here's other things I might do in the executive branch, but, you know, it's a way to kind of signal some of the major portions of the president's agenda in that first-year speech. The second-year speech has those same capabilities as well, but there's a lot more emphasis typically on credit claiming, because now you've served a year in office and you can tout the things that you've done and the effect that you've had. And sometimes that even sets the president up for the further things that they want to request of Congress or to highlight in a State of the Union address.
And I'm curious, you know, we have a 24-hour news cycle now. We have all kinds of social media. Has the importance of the State of the Union changed as far as, you know, are there ever really any surprises now, or have we heard things in bits and pieces, you know, in the year, in the months, in the weeks leading up to it?
It depends, because there is basically a formula for this speech, and each president generally follows it, but there's also enough flexibility with it that presidents can put their imprint on it as well. So you raise an important point about, well, is there anything new here? Sometimes there is. Usually there's not. But with the Trump administration, they have not, like the Obama administration previously, and even the George W. Bush administration before that, kind of telegraphed some of the things that they were going to put in the address. Sometimes presidents will go on the road in the week or two before, go to a particularly symbolically important place to announce an initiative that's being rolled out, and then it's going to be further talked about in the State of the Union address. The Trump administration has not done that, really. It's a lot more mysterious in terms of what exactly they're going to talk about. Certainly, though, we know that he's going to talk about his infrastructure bill. We know that he's going to talk about immigration. And they have even told us those are some of the big topics. Jobs and the economy is another one. Trade and national security are to round that out. But specifically what he's going to say, we don't exactly know. And with Trump, he is more of a wild card in that sense, in that he's hard to predict exactly how he's going to treat this speech. He was very outside of the norm, for example, in terms of how he delivered his inauguration address. So there's some expectations that we generally have with presidents, but you always do want to pay attention to what imprint each president puts on this particular speech, and that's one of the things we're waiting to see with Trump here in tonight's speech.
And I want to dig into some of those specific issues, but how does this speech come to be? Who generally, and again, this is a presidency that has often kind of forged its own ways on different things, but how does this speech usually come together? Who has input?
Well, a lot of people do, and even more people want to have input on it than can get that input. It is a standard speech, and it's both important and there can be too much made of it. So within the administration, out in the executive agencies, for example, there are people lobbying to get their initiatives and their programs and maybe even other people that have the president's ear into that particular speech. Will it make the cut or will it not? Certainly there's speech writers that contribute to it as well. And for this reason, sometimes the speech is denigrated as usually a quote-unquote laundry list of things that it's, you know, not artfully put together, that it doesn't make a lot of sense, and some of those can sometimes ring true. Nevertheless, it does give us an insight into, within the administration writ large, what they have chosen to talk about, how they've chosen to highlight it. What's gotten left out is sometimes as important as what gets put in. And just because it is or is not in the speech doesn't mean that the president's going to get what he wants, for example, because, presidents have to work with Congress. And when I do research in this area, we're particularly looking at legislative requests here and whether the presidents get those or not. But one of the aspects of this speech that is somewhat troubling to people who study the presidency many times is the fact that it does further this notion of presidency-centered government that isn't really in line with how we should think about American government. If you think about the Constitution, Congress's duties are laid out in Article 1, the first article. The executive branch is in Article 2. Over time, the president has gained some power, as we all know. But the simple act of the president going to Congress, being in the middle of the House of Representatives with the cabinet there, with the Supreme Court justices there, with the diplomatic corps there, with all of Congress and their guests, et cetera, and the president's literally at the center of that, it gives us this perception that presidents are the center of the political universe in the United States. Now, certainly presidents are important, but we oftentimes make more of them than we should because the nature of our government is that presidents can propose, but Congress has to work through the details of legislation. And so presidents campaign in this way as they go across the country, and candidates who want to be president will say, my administration will do this, I will do this if you elect me. But most of those things also take cooperation of other actors, particularly Congress. So it is one of the, you know, center's speeches that the president gives, and there's a lot of attention on him. And good presidents, all presidents, take advantage of the fact that they're on the spotlight and they highlight the things that they want to highlight. You know, one of the things that's really difficult in the aftermath of the State of the Union is, you know, the person who has to give the response, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, the opposition party has to give a response to this speech. And it's rarely done well, or at least and if it is done well, people then just don't comment on it. We remember the ones that have kind of gone awry. And so it's important that we recognize we're kind of comparing apples to oranges there. The president's in a room with a live audience. People who give speeches know that you feed off the power of the people in the room. Typically, the response is given to a TV camera, and there's oftentimes not an audience there. And so it's a really difficult act to follow in that sense.
We're talking with Donna Hoffman. She's professor of political science and department head at the University of Northern Iowa. And we're getting a preview of tonight's State of the Union address, which I should say you'll be able to hear live here on the Ideas Network starting at 8 o'clock. And Donna, you mentioned that the State of the Union is a time when the president makes requests of Congress. What possible requests might we hear from President Trump tonight?
Well, I would think that he would talk about what he wants to see in an immigration bill. This is something that he's given different signals on in terms of what he wants. We have potentially another shutdown looming. The current CR runs out on February 8th. So immigration is one of those things. The president has long talked about an infrastructure bill, and this is something that he talked about doing early in the first year that didn't get done, and is still something that we expect him to talk about. And again, there, he's said some kind of contradictory things about what he's looking for in this particular bill. And so this is, again, a crafted speech, and he's going to be reading it off a teleprompter. So we typically expect not a lot of ad-libbing and that kind of thing. So it might give us kind of a clear sense of where the administration wants to go with infrastructure, with immigration. In particular, you know, one of the other things besides requesting policy that presidents do in this speech is they tout what they've already done. And this is what we call credit claiming. And so I highly expect the president to talk a lot about his tax bill and to talk about jobs and to talk about the economy and weaving all of those things together as being connected. We know from his guest list that he has some people from Staub Manufacturing, for example. I think the owners and maybe a worker are there, that in the bio that was released by the White House talks about how this particular company was able to give a larger Christmas bonus because of the tax bill. And so I would expect those are people that are recognized in the speech, and they might even stand up because this is something that Trump is, you know, it's one of his major legislative accomplishments in the first year and something that he's going to talk pretty extensively about. And presidents do generally spend quite a bit of time talking about the economy, but also talking about the things that they have accomplished in the year before.
Donna Hoffman is with us right now to preview tonight's State of the Union speech by President Trump. She's professor of political science and department head at the University of Northern Iowa. And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. What do you expect to hear in President Trump's State of the Union address tonight? What would you like to hear? And what do you think of some of the guests who are being invited to the address? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue this conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our preview of tonight's State of the Union address with Donna Hoffman. She's a professor of political science and department head at the University of Northern Iowa. And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What would you like to hear the president say during his State of the Union address tonight? What do you think the president will tout or downplay? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Donna, we talked about that this is an opportunity for a president to ask, to make requests of Congress. And clearly Congress and all of the other people that you listed who are in the chambers are the direct audience. But how much is this addressed at the American public and kind of trying to get them as allies in the requests that the president is making, or as a way to make sure that the American public knows the things that president is proud of having accomplished?
Yeah, today that really is an important consideration that presidents think about when they're doing this speech. Historically, it wasn't necessarily so true. So for a large part of the 19th century, the speech was a written message that was sent to Congress. And in the 20th century, it became something that presidents started to deliver orally. Washington and Adams had both done it that way, but then from Jefferson to Woodrow Wilson was a written message. And part of the reason why Wilson took this back to Congress was that so he could have their attention and give a speech, dominate news coverage, but, you know, try to lead Congress is in particular what Wilson had in mind. And then it wasn't until, you know, in the mid part of the 20th century that the address, we have radio, of course, first. The addresses are on the radio, but then in 47 they become to be televised, but they're still in the middle of the day. In 1965, Lyndon Johnson recognizes that the speech delivery time could be moved to primetime television and the audience would expand in that sense. And so technology has certainly affected this. And then it wasn't until there was a specific point at which the American public becomes part of the greeting in terms of, you know, the salutation as we go into the speech. So with television cameras in primetime, presidents do oftentimes think that they can talk about a policy proposal. Obviously, they're talking to Congress, but they're also talking to the American public. And the hope here is that they can get the American public, potentially, to put pressure on their members of Congress to support the president in this sense. We know from political science research that rarely actually works, but presidents think it works. And certainly, highlighting their agenda is important, and also influencing media coverage of, you know, what goes on the next day can be important as well. And there are various, you know, strategies that presidents have in the immediate aftermath of the State of the Union address. Many times recent presidents have gone on the road, and they will go to particular locations and tout one of the particular policy proposals that they talked about. And you know, they might go to a business or a community college, something that would be affected by what they talked about in hopefully a positive way, obviously, because that's what they're touting. And so they do try to get the public on board. The question remains, how much does the public pay attention to this speech? You know, we know that the viewing audience has gone down over the years. And, you know, certainly people in the age of cable television have a lot more things by which they cannot watch the State of the Union. You don't have to watch it anymore if, you know, you have more than just the three networks as we used to have. And so there's a lot of distractions. Nevertheless, even if people don't, you know, necessarily watch the speech, it's still, the content of it still does filter to the public quite a bit in terms of the media coverage because it is such an emphasized speech. And the president then typically follows up with these kinds of policy proposals that he's talked about. And again, it's usually things that are going to be highlighted throughout the rest of the year.
And one way that people can watch the State of the Union speech, of course, now is online. And the Trump campaign website has caught a bit of heat for soliciting $35 or more donations from people, with the trade-off being the ability to see their name flash under the president while he delivers the State of the Union. That's part of the live stream on the campaign website. How much of that is a departure from previous State of the Unions, and how politicized that speech might be or might not be?
That's quite a bit of a departure. I mean, there always have been multiple ways, not always, but since the age of the Internet, there have been multiple ways that you can stream it. And certainly, I'm guessing, you know, other parties, the Democratic Party, probably had that capability in prior addresses. News media organizations typically will have a live stream. So there's a lot of choice that you have there. But then linking, you know, the chyron underneath with names is actually, you know, something that is a fundraising technique, I suppose, of the RNC, if that is indeed what they're doing. I hadn't seen that yet. But, you know, there are a lot of evolutions that this speech goes through that are affected by technology. I mean, it used to be that you couldn't live stream it. You had to watch it live. And if you couldn't watch it live, you couldn't watch it. You would have to read about it or, you know, get the transcript. So the ability to not just live stream it, but then to watch it on demand is something that can be useful for people who, you know, can't watch it live, obviously, if they want to watch it.
Let's go to the phones. And Peter in Madison is up. Hi, Peter.
Hi, I'm not really all that curious about what Trump has to say, because he's just going to read something that his handlers prepared for him, and I don't really think it's going to correspond probably to anything he might pursue, except for maybe the infrastructure package. But I'm curious what the guest thinks of the person that was chosen by the Democrats to give the response and what her impressions of the person who gives the response is.
Great. Thanks for that, Peter.
Yeah, usually the whoever is giving the opposition response is carefully picked, and they're usually picked for symbolic reasons. And they picked Joe Kennedy III to give the Democratic Party response. There are also sometimes competing responses, because basically anybody can do this if they can get the media attention to, you know, call it a response of a certain group. The Tea Party, for example, several years ago did a particular response outside of the Republican response to Obama. So there's a lot of thought that goes into this, who is going to give the response. It's usually done for some kind of symbolic reason. Last year it was Governor Beshear of Kentucky, I believe, who was a Democratic governor in a red state, and that was something that the Democrats wanted to highlight. I would have actually thought that, given what's going on in the environment right now, the Democrats would have picked a prominent female lawmaker to give the speech, but they didn't. And nevertheless, it's always somebody who's a rising star, typically, in that sense. But this is a hard speech to give. The ones that we remember from recent years, Bobby Jindal, not having a very good on-camera presence in one of his responses to Barack Obama. Marco Rubio grabbing his water bottle to drink from it as well. And so this is something that, as I mentioned earlier, it's a really hard speech to give because you're typically just before the cameras. And then you're responding to a speech, and not as many people are going to pay attention to it. And if you do it well, people probably won't really remember it that much. If you do it poorly, though, people will remember it.
So it sounds like a really tough position to be put in. If people really don't comment if you do it well, they tend to just remember if you do it badly. Is it a good platform, though, in some way, for someone who might not be well known to first kind of get in front of that large audience?
It can, but there's also other ways, you know, to do that that might even be a little bit less high stakes in that sense. But certainly it is a way to elevate your public profile. You might be somebody who's well known in the Beltway, for example, but not so well known out in the United States more broadly. And, you know, it is a signal of confidence if the party picks you to give this particular speech. And so, again, these people who are picked are done for various symbolic reasons, and also in terms of their skill, and also in terms of what they think the future might hold for them as well. So there are a lot of different strategies the parties put into this, and it varies from year to year.
And, Donna, briefly, as we wrap up, is there one thing that you personally are going to be watching for in tonight's State of the Union?
Well, I challenged one of my classes today to, because we talk about the difference that presidents have to, a difference they have to bridge between campaigning and governing, because campaigning takes one skill set, governing actually takes a different skill set. Presidents oftentimes have a hard time figuring out that distinction. And so I told my class today, and this is something that I'll be watching for as well, because Trump is usually in campaign mode. And will the speech be geared to that campaign mode? Will he, you know, in particular be speaking more to his base than to the United States as a whole? Or will he be able to shift to governing mode, which would not just be talking to the United States as a whole, but talking about unifying themes, talking even about working with the other side, because governing typically takes some element of compromise, not just doubling down on a partisan position. So I think that's an important thing to look for. The White House has also said that, you know, President Trump is going to be a bit more unifying in terms of his rhetoric as well, and maybe a little bit more optimistic.
And we'll leave it there. Donna, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Donna Hoffman is a professor of political science and department head at the University of Northern Iowa. She joined us today to preview President Trump's State of the Union address tonight, which you can hear live right here on the Ideas Network at 8 o'clock.